flutist James Galway playing a sonata by Bach with viola da gamba player Sarah Cunningham and harpsichordist Philip Mall. You know, I was also reading on Mr. Galway's website that he finds that as he's getting older, he can't always play things all in one breath like he used to. I didn't think he'd just, you know, stop dead in the middle of a movement like that, though. Just kidding, Mr. Galway.
This is WHFR Dearborn, and thank you for listening today. If you would like to get into some classic old-time radio mystery drama, then we've got just the show for you. It's called, simply put, Old-Time Radio Mysteries, and it airs every Monday evening at 11 p.m. right here on 89.3 FM. We play shows like Inner Sanctum, The Weird Circle, Suspense, and so many more. It is that great classic old-time scary radio mysteries from days gone by, and we know you're going to like it. So check it out again, Old Time Radio Mysteries, Monday evenings, 11 until the midnight hour, right here on WHFR. The next performance of the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra is coming up Friday, March 14th. It's called the American Showcase, and if you'd like to learn more about ticket information or additional details about the American Showcase, call the Dearborn Symphony office 313-565-2424.
Hi, I'm Gillian Martin.
The station making waves. Stay tuned for Then and Now.
Morning. You are listening to Then and Now, presented on WHFR Dearborn from 10 to 11 a.m. and the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of the WHFR Forum, our weekly talk show format. Then and Now is a pre-recorded program on WHFR at 89.3 FM, Making Waves, that primarily deals with how history affects current events. And now to our host, Ned Apigian, with today's program. Ned?
Thank you. Well, our program today is the history of Zionism, and our guest is Mr. Alan Gale. And Mr. Gale, welcome, and thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me, Ned. Let me just tell you that my office is the Jewish Community Relations Council, which is in metropolitan Detroit. It's the public affairs arm of the organized Jewish community here in Southeast Michigan.
Well, you saved me from saying that. Thanks. Now all I have to tell you is about your background. Mr. Gale holds degrees from the University of Minnesota and Midrasha College of Jewish Studies and completed Hebrew language studies in Israel. He has taught in Jewish religious schools and is a frequent guest lecturer in public and private high schools and colleges. Alan holds a respected reputation as a community relations consultant and has served as a speaker or panelist at local and national conferences. Mr. Gale is a member of the board of the Detroit Council of World Affairs and the Jewish National Fund and is a past board member of the NAACP Oakland County, Temple Emmanuel, and the Jewish Heartland magazine. Well, Mr. Gale is certainly experienced at discussing this topic, and we hope we can make some sense out of it. Zionism is a word that's thrown around, and my guess is somewhat misunderstood, and we need to shed some light on it. We're going to begin in the beginning, Alan. But tell us something about its founding in 1897 by Theodor Herzl and something about him and what were the reasons that brought on the foundation?
Well, I think it might be helpful to look at the dictionary definition of Zionism, which for most people in the Jewish community is the return of the Jewish people to their ancient homeland, which is Israel today. Of course, it was British, and then before that, Turkish Palestine before that. But not just a return to their ancient homeland, but an effort by the Jews at that time for self-determination. And what this really did was it created a major revolution in Jewish life, because before that, for some 2,000 years, Jews were not in political control in the places where they lived. And we can get into that later, but I think that that's important to state at the outset.
So Theodore's interest was more political than it was religious, obviously.
That's right. In fact, part of the history of this is the fact that prior to the French Revolution, the Jewish communities in Europe and in other parts of the world were primarily faith communities. But once the French Revolution came about and liberated the Jews, in other words, brought them out of their ghettos, and the famous Napoleonic term was, to the Jew as a citizen, everything. To the Jew as a member of a faith community, nothing. In other words, equal rights as an individual, but not as a member of a faith community. Then the secular aspect of the Jewish community really began and grew. And it really was the secular aspect, the secular community of Jews in Europe that created and promulgated the beginning of Zionism.
Well, tell us something about Theodor Herzl, how and why he's the father of Zionism.
Well, let me go back just a few years before Herzl as
okay.
Well. I mean, I think that most Jews would say that the start of Zionism was 1882, which was a period in Europe when there were severe and serious and really criminal pogroms against Jews in Eastern Europe and in Russia, and it provoked a reaction of Jews to say, we have to get out of here, we have to go someplace where we can defend ourselves, where we can determine our own future. And the first group that was created was one called Bilu, which took its name from a biblical phrase of getting up and going. And this was something that Jews had not done. They had basically been settled in Europe and not been in control. And here was an effort to say, if the Jew is to become his own man, then he needs to take action. And this was, and I think we also have to look at what was happening in the rest of the world, because if you looked at before that period, travel was not something which was common. And people basically were born and lived their lives and died in the same village or town in which their family was. But in the 1800s, travel began to become more common, either by boat or by train. And I think so it was more common for people, including Jews, to be able to say, we can leave a place where we are being persecuted. So it was in 1882 as a reaction to great pogroms in Eastern Europe.
What does that word come from?
Pogrom?
What, is it a German word or Russian word?
Actually, I don't know, but it means anti-Semitic riot. It means
the definition.
Yes, non-Jews would come into a Jewish village or a Jewish part of town, and they would cause injury or death to Jews, and they would damage property or destroy it.
Would this be primarily in Tsarist Russia?
It would be primarily there, but it also took place in other countries as well. And it was very severe in 1880, 1881, 1882, and from that rose the Bilu movement, where Jews began to say, we need to go somewhere where we can begin a new life and perhaps in the future gain political authority. And that was when the movement toward Israel, of course it was Turkish Palestine at the time, began. That's actually called the period of the first Aliyah. Aliyah is a Hebrew word which means to go up. And this was, it was from the biblical interpretation by the Jews that going up, that improving yourself would be would be part of what was the movement to Israel, or of course Turkish Palestine at the time.
Okay, so this I always thought Emma Lazarus's poem had to do with this pogroms in Russia. That's what she was really addressing in her poem. That was my feeling at all times, she being a Jewish poet on the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, that I can't comment on. I'm not sure what the history of that
was. Seems logical. She was concerned.
Possibly, except that, of course, you know, the Jews who had come to America were having different struggles, but certainly not pogroms. And so really the focus of this was what was happening in Eastern Europe to the Jewish communities. They were being destroyed, they were being threatened. And of course, so that these efforts began then in 1882. And there were a few minor players and minor movements that related to it. And then, of course, your original question was about Theodor Herzl. And who was he, why was he so important?
Right.
And Theodor Herzl was an Austrian Jew who was a journalist, who was a very secular, assimilated Jew. But as part of his assignment as a journalist, he was sent to France to cover the Dreyfus trial. And if you know the history there,
I do.
Colonel Dreyfus was accused of being a spy and a traitor, and he was convicted and sent to Devil's Island.
1894.
I think that's right. And of course, it was known all along by most Frenchmen that this was a setup. That this was merely an anti-Semitic act to try to limit Jewish advancement in the French armed forces and throughout French society. Because of course, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, whereas Napoleon had emancipated the Jews, there was a reaction. Whenever there's an action, of course, in history, there's a reaction. So though the Jews were emancipated and became secular, many of them became secular and then also advanced in society, socially, culturally, and economically, there was a backlash. The Catholic Church led some of the backlash, and certainly the ruling classes, and so Jews who were moving through French society, including in the army, there was a backlash against them, and that was really the purpose of the Dreyfus trial.
Well, they had to blame somebody, so it's always convenient to blame the Jew, and they found him.
maybe you can tell us the definition of the word scapegoat. Goat.
Yeah, that's. I think who the eventual traitor was somebody else. They just blamed it on him.
And that could be. But okay. Of course, that was a time when Germany and France were bitter enemies, and I think what happened was Dreyfus was accused of being a spy for Germany.
Yeah, I do. Exactly. So in 1897...
Here comes a secular, assimilated Jewish journalist from Austria to cover this trial, and he is just shocked by what he learns and what he sees and hears. Mm-hmm. And of course, the end of the trial is it's a setup, it's a fraud, and Dreyfus is sent off to Devil's Island, the infamous prison. Mm-hmm. And later, Emile Zola writes a book called J'accuse, which exposes the fraud.
Right.
I accuse, which exposes the fraud. But this whole episode motivated Herzl to say that Jews are not safe, even in the most liberated, enlightened societies, as France thought it was.
So they must do what?
They must do what? They must leave Europe and go to Palestine and work to create their own state.
Now, what made him think the Turks were going to allow him to do that?
Well, you know, he was a dreamer. And one of the things, you know, interesting, people don't realize he made such a great name for himself, particularly in the Jewish community, but his activity only lasted 7 years. Did you know that, Ned?
No, I wasn't.
He
sure.
died in 1904.
Oh.
So that, but his activity was great. So great and so, so active. He went around and visited heads of state, including the Catholic heads and the Muslim heads and the European heads, of course, trying to get support for the creation of a Jewish state. And he created, really, out of these minor movements, which I had spoken about earlier, mm-hmm. the ones that started around 1880, a cohesive movement called Political Zionism. And he convened in 1897 the first International Zionist Congress.
In Basel, Switzerland.
In Basel, Switzerland. And these Jewish leaders came from around the world to begin talking about what it would take to create a Jewish state. And there were several of these congresses. They were held yearly. And, of course, the last one that Herzl was at was in 1904, because that was the year that he died.
Presumably these were all to take place in Palestine. Not in Madagascar.
Well, actually, they took place. The congresses themselves took place in Europe.
Yes,
but the main focus was to get Jews to settle in Palestine and to begin building the pre-state institutions that would be needed once a state could be declared.
Well, at first, you have to make sure that there could be refugees would be allowed to come into the Turkish Ottoman Empire. I don't know what the Sultan thought about that. Because that brings me to a point, the period from up to 1908. I don't know what the attitude of the Sultan and the Sultanate was, but in 1908 there was pre-World War I, there was a revolution in Turkey. The Young Turks took over the government, left the Sultan. So that period, does that have any meaning to Zionism? In other words, post the Sultan or pre the Sultan, as far as you're concerned?
No, I don't think so. I know that I know you're looking at the particular major events in that part of the world in that time of history. Mm-hmm. But the way the Jewish community looks at this is what was motivating Jews at the time to leave and to go to Palestine. And as I said, the first Aliyah, the first emigration movement, was in 1882. The second one was in 1903.
They actually went to Palestine? They were allowed
There were thousands of Jews, tens of thousands, who went between 1882 and 1903. Another wave began in 1903 because there was an upsurge in pogroms in Europe at that time. So 1903 to 1905 was also a major time of movement. Now, you ask me about Jews moving there and the...
So, okay, let me remind our audience that they are listening to a pre-recorded program, and you are listening to Then and Now, a program which studies how current events are affected by history. And that's where we're trying to go with this, to give you some background on Zionism so you can find out where the beginnings of some of our problems that we see in the Middle East today. They just didn't grow out of the air. They have some basis in the past. And you are listening to WHFR 89.3 FM, the student radio station at the Henry Ford Community College, and I am your host, Ned Apigian, and you are listening to our guest, who is Mr. Alan Gale, and Mr. Gale is making sure we have some understanding about Zionism. And Mr. Gale, can we continue? So let me kind of talk about these periods and see if you have any. We know, at least I do, something about the Balfour Agreement, which is pre-World War I and then post-World War I. These periods obviously have something to do with Zionism, because the Balfour Agreement came after the First World War, which is an agreement between the British government and supposedly promises to the Jewish people. Is that correct?
I think what I wanted to say, Ned, is the first two Aliyot, the ones that started in 1882 and then in 1903, were significant, but they weren't great numbers. I don't have the exact numbers, but they were in the tens of thousands. I think at the time of World War I, there were less than 50,000 Jews in Palestine. So that the period of real opportunity and growth for the Jewish community and for their dream of creating their own state did not begin until, as you just said, 1917, when the British were about to defeat the Turks in that part of the world and then create a new constellation.
Well, they wanted everybody to fight with them again. We all know the Lawrence of Arabia story. They had asked the Arabs to fight with them, and they would give them recognize their independence, and they did the same thing to not only actually did the same thing to the Armenians, as a matter of fact. The idea that you could have during the First World War, I don't think people realized that there were efforts to create organized Jewish military outfits to fight for the British during this period. Do you have any, is that serious? Was it?
I know there were small numbers that did create a Jewish battalion. Some of those volunteers came from the Middle East, others from Europe. Mm. I think there was a reason for that, was to get on the side of the British in that battle, to gain some favor from them once the war was over, because it looked like that the British and the French eventually were going to win that war, and then to get them to be favorable to the establishment of a Jewish state. And really, that's how the Balfour Declaration came about. It was an effort by the British to solidify Jewish support for the British war effort and to promise the Jews a homeland and place for self-determination once the war was over.
So that period was definitely important. They owed those. As I mentioned, I know the French formed a thing called the Armenian Legion that fought in the Middle East. And also in the Tsarist army, none of these people ever delivered on what they promised. Hence, Lawrence of Arabia. So 1918 to 23, this is a period that the official peace treaty ending the World War I with Turkey is called the Peace Treaty of Sèvres, and then it was changed to the Peace Treaty of Lausanne. This peace treaty is ending World War I. Do we have any Zionist ambitions proclaimed in any of these two documents? Because I know in the peace treaty of Sèvres, which is a French word, its pronunciation, how it's spelled is maddening, they made promises to the Kurds to establish a Kurdistan as well. Also to the Armenians, which there was an Armenia established, which later the Turkish Republic defeated militarily in 1921.
I would say during that diplomatic period, as you could, the years following World War I, there was a lot of Jewish diplomatic activity, particularly by a man named Chaim Weizmann, who was a British citizen, who was very much involved as both an observer and as a background person in those negotiations, to try to generate support for what the Balfour Declaration in 1917 had promised. And I think that when the British the British first took military control of Palestine in 1918 and didn't really establish civilian control until, I think, 1920 or 22, when those treaties came into effect. The League of Nations mandate. Yes, the League of Nations mandate came about in, I think, 1920, and I think the British took control in 21 or 22, and that was when the British then had control.
Actually, they controlled it anyway, so they.
Well, they controlled it militarily, but then they got the.
They got the blessing of
right,
the legal aid.
And the league. That's right, the legality of it. But at any rate, at that point, then it was really up to the British to decide how many Jews to enter the country, and how many, and what freedoms they would have.
Right. So 1923 right. to actually 1939, the beginning of war, this 16-year period, there was immigration by European Jews to Palestine.
Well, that's right. In some points it was limited, in some points not so much, and we can talk about that. There really were two other major periods of immigration just after World War I, and then also in 1933.
With the Nazi government telling
the Jews, we're not going to kill you now if you can go somewhere. The only place they were able to go, very few places. One of them was Palestine. I think about 50,000 German Jews were able to flee to Palestine between 1933 and 1936. And what happened in 1936, there was an Arab revolt against that immigration. So, and actually, Arab revolts began actually back in 1920. There was Arab rioting in Jerusalem at the beginning of the British rule, because of the competition they felt from the Jews who were living there at the time.
Let me go back to post World War One. The Bolsheviks exposed when they took over the Russian government, they exposed the plans of the French and the English to divide the Ottoman Empire among themselves. In a document, the British was Sykes, the Frenchman was Picot. The Lawrence of Arabia movie kind of indicates that division. Is there anything in that period that you're aware of that there were... what the British and the French had for the plans for the Jewish issue?
I don't believe so, because, again, I don't think there were that many Jews living in Palestine at the time. I don't think that the British and the French were interested in dealing with a Jewish problem. They merely produced the Balfour Declaration in order to garner Jewish support for their war effort toward the end of World War One. Mm-hmm. And I think that, the British really were speaking from both sides when they controlled Palestine. For most of those years, there was open immigration of Jews, but they also were limiting Jewish immigration from time to time, and they were limiting Jewish power, and they were not they were not in favor for most of that period, from 1918 to 1948, in favor of of the creation of a Jewish state.
How about the French? Now, they took Lebanon and Syria. Was there a Jewish question for Lebanon and Syria? Was there an attempt by the Jews living in Lebanon and Syria to leave and go to Palestine? Or we know that the British, were influential in creating Jordan. They took the three princes from Mecca, Prince Abdullah, and made him king of Jordan. Then they took Faisal.
I'm not aware of that. There was a Jewish community in France. Whether they were involved in the Zionist effort, I don't know. I know that there was a large Jewish community in North Africa, which was under the control of the French, and many of them, after Israel's creation, went to Israel to live as citizens in the new country.
Now, this is a question about Zionism that I've heard before, that many Jews, where it's absolutely 100% everybody is for Israel, and after all, Israel is the end product of the Zionist dream, that they thought the Zionists were crazy. Like American Jews said, we're here, we're not going to Palestine, we're not going to the desert. It took a long while for the Zionist idea to be accepted in America and other places. What do you have to say about that by looking at Europe? Were there different places this settled idea made more sense than
I
others?
I think there was a political continuum. I think that the idea was embraced by most Jews. I think that there was perhaps another segment which were indifferent to it, and I think there was another segment which were opposed, and that opposition really did not grow. I think it continued to shrink, and even today there's a wild radical sect called Naturei Karta, which is against Zionism. But let me tell you that Zionism fundamentally was a revolution for the Jewish community, because if you look at the history of Jews for the 2,000 years before Zionism, they were a faith community. They spoke the language of the country where they lived. They were dependent on the economies and the political ability of the majority, and they were always the minority. They were not known as people that were physically fit and able to defend themselves, and they certainly were a weak community. And what happened with Zionism is a total flip of that. They became the movement was led by secular Jews who maybe had a strong feeling about Jewish history and Jewish ritual and the Jewish present and the Jewish future, but they weren't as committed to the religious life. They created a new language, or took an ancient language and made it modern. And I'm talking about the language Hebrew, which was spoken really only in religious schools and in religious services before then. And today...
did that after the creation of the State of Israel.
No. There was a famous man named Eliezer ben Yehuda who created the modern language of Hebrew in the 1890s. This was a language of the Bible, which only had a few thousand words, and to be able to use it and to refer to modern things and where there weren't any words for those things. So Eliezer ben Yehuda really created. He's called the father of modern Hebrew. And today you have 7 million Israelis speaking modern Hebrew, and you know more than 100 years ago or so.
Can they read ancient Hebrew? Is it classical Greek?
That's right. Ancient Hebrew is like Shakespearean English. That's right. It's not anything. Hebrew. Let me just continue. It was the secular community, which hadn't existed before the French Revolution. They created a new language. They became self-sufficient. Jews were not farmers. In fact, they were prohibited from owning land through most of the world, Europe and South Middle Ages and beyond the Middle Ages. And Jews, what they decided to do with Zionism is go into Palestine and buy that land with hard-earned dollars and become self-sufficient farmers. They also became physically fit and created institutions for self-defense. Jews could never do that before. In fact, they were prohibited from owning arms in the previous centuries.
Yeah. You know what was interesting? I mean, we saw that during the Nazi period. I was watching a program the other day about the Jews of America, and the Jews in South in New York, Lower Manhattan, were the Eastern Jews, the Oriental Jews, the Russian Jews, and the German Jews were up further up in Manhattan, and they had a kind of like a jaundiced-eyed attitude about each other. But the thing that was interesting was the Jews from the various countries that were taken by the Germans, they regarded themselves as Germans. The good Germans, here was my medal, I fought in the First World War. It was amazing. So there's a lot of truth about them being secular.
The issue of the French Revolution was that prior to the French Revolution, Jews weren't serving in the army. They weren't allowed to have arms and to be part of defense. And after that, they were citizens. That's
absolutely new
and,
to me.
Yeah, and there was even there's a somewhat of a parallel in American history. Do you know the first Jewish colony the first Jewish people to come to America was when they came to New Amsterdam, which of course at that time was a Dutch colony. Now today is New York, and they were not allowed to be in the militia. Peter Stuyvesant was the leader then of New Amsterdam, and they were not allowed to have other rights. And they petitioned the Dutch, I guess it was called the Dutch East India Company, and they stood behind, and it really was an advance for Jews in this country.
Well, it's time for we're at our midpoint already, and we don't seem to have covered everything we want to hear about this. You are listening to Then and Now, which is a pre-recorded program heard on Saturdays on the fourth Saturday of every month between 10 and 11, part of our talk show format at the station, which goes along with all of our very strange music that covers everything in the world you can imaginable that you can't find on commercial radio. And you are listening to us on the radio station of the Henry Ford Community College. And we're making waves over here today. And you can hear us on the internet at 89.3 FM as well. Let me interject something, see if we can... So that's something about the French Revolution I never had a suspicion of. I just assumed if Jews wanted to go in the army, they went. I mean, who wants to go into the army? I know in the Ottoman Empire, people were limited who could bear arms. I'm familiar with the Ottoman Empire, but I didn't know in Western Europe you couldn't. So now we have the first pre-World War II. We see there's about 50,000 Jews coming to Palestine in a trickle. The English are saying so many, they allow this many, and this creates problems with the Arabs. And now comes World War II. From everybody knows the story of what happened to the Jews in World War II. We're not going to cover that here. The important thing
it's
was...
It's important, though, Ned. I don't think you dismiss the murder of 6 million Jews.
No, what I meant is I'm trying to justify for the Jews the effort they made fighting with the British, especially in North Africa and the Middle East. There they are learning, getting credit for, again, trying to buy into some future deal that they can make in the future. That most people don't know anything about. And I'd like you to say something about that. Is that Zionist-led, or is Zionism directly involved with that?
I think there was a little bit of a difference. The Jewish Legion in World War One was particularly to side with the British in that conflict and to gain their favor on the establishment of a Jewish state. But in World War II, people knew, particularly the Jews, knew that Jews were being murdered by the German forces, mm-hmm. and they were itching to get involved in that fight. And they created out of the Jews in Palestine a Palestine Brigade, which was served very honorably and heroically, particularly in Italy, and it was not really to curry favor with the British. It was to fight the Germans who were killing their brethren.
Well, the Polish had the same thing in Italy too. They had Polish units in Italy too. You know what I found interesting? I was watching a program the other day. There are so many programs about the Jewish story. One was that in the concentration camps, they let somebody go to Switzerland. Apparently there's a Jewish community there, and they were going to let some Hungarian Jews come out of Hungary, because Hungary was an ally of Germany at that time, and then for 10,000 trucks or something. I didn't know. So there was an active Jewish community, which the Nazis, in a strange way, were dealing with, trying to get things from and promise them things.
I'm not aware of that story, but during certain parts of the war, the German war effort was failing, and they were interested in that kind of thing.
But they basically
dehumanized Jews, and
nothing else they could do. I mean, but this particular group of people eventually were sent from Hungary to Germany, and they did end up leaving Germany. And that's one. I watch all these stories. When I say most people know everything there is to know about that, it's the stuff in the background that they don't know. The issue of Zionism is it's like being a liberal. It's a dirty word. You know, some words are thrown around. I know I ran for office not too long ago, and a guy came up to me and said, "Are you a Zionist?" And I said, "What? What is Zionism?"
Zionism, merely, and I'm repeating myself, is the return of the Jewish people to their ancient homeland for self-determination.
Okay, so now they have done their share in the Second World War, to knowing what the Germans were doing to the Jews of Europe. Again, they participated, and then we have the story of the Exodus, the Jews trying to leave to come to Palestine. And what we see is from 1945 to 48, essentially an argument with the British in terms of how many is enough, is too many. And, of course, this bothers the Arabs. And the whole reason for this program is so people understand that this promise that the Jewish people, being unsettled in where they lived for so long, said, "I need to find a place where I can be safe and secure, and I'm deciding on Palestine, not Madagascar." There was an attempt at one time.
No, there really wasn't. There was some discussion, but not really an attempt.
Well, the Germans seemed to think so.
And the two key words here are ancient homeland. This was our ancient homeland, and I'm not denying the fact that there were Arabs living there at the time, And what the United Nations decided to do in 1947 was to create two states, an Arab state and a Jewish state. And by the way,
Arabs should have taken that deal.
And by the way, the 60% of the Jewish state was desert that was going to be given to them. And the Jews decided to take that deal, and the Arabs did not.
Right.
And if that deal had gone through, there would be no Arab-Israeli conflict, and there would be no Palestinian refugees.
Unfortunately, right.
Unfortunately, they did not take that deal, and we live with the conflict until today.
That is another thing that most people don't really know about, because most people's history is last week's news magazine, today's newspaper, and it doesn't go much farther than that. I always were impressed by the generation that are octogenarians now in Israel. They were talking about the Arab movement, saying, look, we're sympathetic to, we understand because we did the same thing. What we have to do is come to some terms with each other, and unfortunately,
a compromise, a sharing of land, and that's really what the Jews have been saying for a number of decades now.
Well, unfortunately, once you go down one path, you lead to another. So now we have this interesting thing that I learned today about the development of. I always wondered why they keep talking about the Bible, and they says, "Well, you know, I was reading it in Greek." And the real meaning, if you have to know ancient Greek to understand what that meaning was, and I'm saying, where was Hebrew in all this? The interesting thing is the transformation of that land when you look at the diverse cultures and peoples that inhabited the Romans. Then the Greeks came, and it became a Hellenized world. Then the people that lived there, no matter what they were, then came the Muslim invasion of the 8th century and Islamized all these people. Who were they Islamizing? They weren't bringing people from Saudi Arabia. They were transforming the people that lived there, and they became something else. This is people don't realize.
And we know through history that the Jews were expelled from the land once they lost political sovereignty, the sovereignty of ancient Israel, which, of course, was the temples of David and Solomon.
And the Babylonian captivity, these are all interesting stories.
And the priesthood. And so the Jews were actually, again, coming back to their ancient homeland. And while there was an Arab minority living there, the Jews were willing to share that land. And there was a plan to do so in 1937, which the Arabs rejected, and in 1947, which the Arabs rejected, and in recent negotiations back in the year 2000, which Yasser Arafat rejected. And so here we are today with the conflict.
Is there any... I had heard, I'm going to go back to Theodor Herzl, I haven't read this, that what Theodor Herzl brought to this process was, he said, we must become influential wherever we are in all aspects of life in order for us to have controlling interest. We must become newspaper editors, we must own things of communication. We have to be in education. We have to be involved in law. If I was going to prepare myself absolutely instead of doing this off the cuff, I wanted to get a hold of those statements. Are you familiar with any of these?
No, I'm not. In fact, that sounds rather conspiratorial. What I said earlier was that the Jews know that the focus was for self-determination, that the Jews needed to own land, create a self-defense force, have their own language, do things on their own, not use other people's labor, be able to pay for things in cash.
Other people's language.
It was 1901 that the Jewish National Fund was founded for the purpose of paying cold cash for the land in Palestine for Jews to settle.
To buy it from whom? Local Arabs.
Some were bought by local Arabs. Others.
Who was there?
Well, you had absentee landlords living in Saudi Arabia or Lebanon or Syria or elsewhere. But at any rate, the point is that the land was bought with cold cash, and because the Jews wanted to begin the process of creating a pre-state environment that would eventually become a state for the Jews.
So if they couldn't, so the taking of the land from the Arabs wasn't their interest. They wanted to buy what was for sale.
That's correct. And that began in in 1901.
How do you make it contiguous?
Well, that has been a problem.
Understand you might be able to buy a kibbutz something.
That's right, and in fact, in 1947, it was rather blotchy. Arabs living in one place and Jews elsewhere, and sometimes mixed and not so contiguous. But the United Nations solved the problem with a plan accepted by the Jews but rejected by the Arabs, an ability to split the country. And of course, the Arabs rejected that and attacked the Jewish settlements.
There is a labor Zionist organization. Is there a Zionist organization that's worldwide, that has conventions, and they discuss where Zionism should go, where it should retreat, what it should accept? There used to be a labor Zionist organization here in town, too. Actually, one of my college professors
There are Zionist organizations remaining, which basically help in certain ways the state of Israel, but primarily, as Zionism was the return of the Jewish people to their ancient homeland for self-determination, that event took place on May 15th of 1948. We're approaching the 60th anniversary of the creation of Israel. That was the realization of Zionism.
So it's over.
It's over in that sense. In the other sense, certainly Jews around the world want to support Israel, and we call ourselves Zionists because we're in favor of the strengthening and the future of the Jewish people own state.
You don't belong to a Zionist organization with a chapter, conventions, and there are
still Zionist organizations with chapters and conventions, but primarily
they
are there to support the state, to lobby in their home country for support for Israel, to raise some funds for people living in Israel. But again, the dream was realized on May 4, 15th, 1948. May 14th.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. May 14th, 1948.
So what did the labor Zionist organization here do? They called themselves that. Now they changed their name to something like you're talking about.
Amenu, which is our nation. Because
Hebrew word.
Part of the issue, and as I mentioned, it was primarily secular Jews who founded the
state.
They were also, many of them, socialists.
And labor
movement people. Yeah. And so the labor movements in Israel began in the 1920s and were very strong and were participated in the building of the pre-state institutions. And so they had supporting groups in different parts of the world as well, which was called labor Zionism.
So would you say most of the leftist movement in America, which there are a lot of Jews in it, you think those people were Zionists as well as being leftist because of their sense of the justice of being
Yes,
left, you know?
Absolutely.
You think they were Zionists as well?
Yes, I think they were. Yes.
I know one thing. I don't know how many people would have went to the Spanish Civil War in the 30s if you took all the Jews out of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Because wherever there's something happening, they're usually there in some very progressive movement.
Progressive and social justice, these are things that come out of Jewish teaching and tradition.
And, I'm sure you knew, I thought it was interesting, that actually the Soviet Union was the first state to recognize the state of Israel. Everybody thinks it was the United States.
They
don't know much about history.
Right. Look, the United Nations really didn't have a large membership at the time, and the Cold War had just begun, and for whatever reason, the Soviets felt that it was important that they recognize new states. I think people point to that, but I think if you look at the votes...
I don't see it as a negative.
Right.
If
you look at the votes of the Soviets throughout that period, whenever a new nation was created, they would vote in favor because they were currying favor. There was a Cold War going on, and they were trying to get these new nations to side with them. Israel primarily was non-aligned at the beginning of after its birth, but it became more closely aligned with the U.S. Within the first 10 years, and of course today is one of the United States' strongest allies.
The 51st state. Strong.
Some people say that, but not really true.
Anyway, it's time for to us identify our wonderful guest, Mr. Alan Gale, who's been teaching us a lot about the history of Zionism and what it means. And you are listening to Then and Now, which is a talk show format broadcast on WHFR 89.3 FM on the fourth Saturday of every month from 10 to 11. And if you're listening to us, don't try to call the station because we are pre-recorded and I would be eternally frustrated as to what to do if the phone rang. And we have another 10 minutes or so, exactly 10 minutes, to allow Mr. Gale to tell us what's the... How about this issue of Zionism is racism? What's the Zionist answer to that? That slogan.
Well,
What do you think they mean by that?
I don't know. It's a total fraud.
There are non-Jews in Palestine.
You're right. You've given me half the answer. There are over a million non-Jews in Palestine who are full citizens, and the Jewish faith has no color line. And in fact, there are 100,000 black Ethiopian Jews living in Israel today. The Jewish state of Israel rescued the Ethiopian Jews in two miraculous airlifts, one in the 1980s, one in 1984, and the other in 1991.
I remember.
And it's the first example in modern history of black Africans being taken out of their continent to freedom. And I think that's something that most Jews are very, very proud of, that these 100,000 Jews of Ethiopia wanted to come to Israel to fulfill their Jewish life and to live in freedom with other Jews.
Well, I imagine the reason for that statement, your explanation is wonderful about racism, is that what the Arabs want, their idea is to have a Palestine in which Christians, Jews, and Muslims can live together in peace, and they are opposed to there being a Jewish state. I think that's what they mean by Zionism.
And what you have today, Ned, is an Israel where Christians, Jews, and Muslims live together in peace. And what Israel is trying to create is a Palestine where Palestinians can then have a determination on their own future.
Well, I only wanted to throw the term out there because you see it a lot, and I thought maybe you might. Your explanation was good to try to make some explanation as to Israel is a place of which there are. I know there's a Armenian community in Israel. Actually, one quarter of the old city is called the Armenian Quarter.
That's correct. I was there just recently, a few weeks ago.
And nobody knows why.
It's a beautiful place. Well, we know why, because after the Crusader period, the Christians wanted to have closer control of the Christian holy sites in Jerusalem, and so they settled some of their people and their priests in Jerusalem, and later to become the Christian Quarter in the Armenian Quarter. The Armenian Church is one of the five churches that has portion of control over the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the holiest site in Christendom in the city of Jerusalem.
I didn't know that. I happen to have a friend that was born in Jerusalem, and he speaks perfect Arabic and Hebrew. In fact, he even does a Seder thing at dinner on Friday, and you would never know the difference. He also was like a pastor at a Protestant church as well. He's a very, very nice man. He told me the story about that, which was slightly different. At the time of the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans, by that time Armenia was conquered by Rome as well, and was a vassal state. And apparently there must have been some Armenian units from the Roman army that took part in this sack of Jerusalem, and he said that's the reason for there being an Armenian quarter. I was mystified by it, because the Crusaders wouldn't have much interest in. I mean, the Crusaders found interesting Christian people, old Christian people in the Near East, which was strikingly new for them, that turned out to be helpful to them. But I don't know which story is true.
I'm not aware of that, so I couldn't comment.
It has nothing to do with Zionism. So how about these Jewish organizations? I should have wrote the name back. IPAC, APAC, AI, America, Israel. What do these have to do with Zionism directly? The lobbies in America.
Right.
Anything?
Well, I think that...
They don't think of themselves as carrying on Theodore Herzl's...
No, they certainly don't. They know that today almost 6 million Jews live in Israel, and they are concerned about those people. There are only some 14 million Jews in the entire world. How many people live in this world? Over 5 billion. But only 14 million Jews, so we're a very small, close-knit community which is very concerned about our own future, and almost 6 million live in Israel, and of course Israel is a strong ally of the United States, so we feel very comfortable in lobbying for the continuation of that relationship, that close, warm relationship between Israel and the United States. But you have two democracies, you have with shared similar interests, shared strategic interests. You have a war on terror which is going on, which the Israelis and the Americans cooperate in fighting. So there are many, many reasons why the U.S. and Israel should maintain a close relationship, and we feel very comfortable as a Jewish community in lobbying for that to continue, just like any other lobbyist would do.
Zionism is an antiquated idea that's come to its fruition. And
well, I don't think it's antiquated. It's
I mean, it's finished.
It's living. It's
May 14th.
It May 14th, 1948. It came to fruition, and now the Zionism is what is the
present? The
state what of is the present? What is the future for the Jews, not only in the world, but particularly those several million who live in Israel?
Is it the purpose of Zionism to bring as many Jews out from the rest of the world to Israel?
Absolutely, yes, it is.
They like that idea.
That's one of the goals of the Israeli leadership and the people there is to and at this point.
Why do the Israelis come here then? I mean, after they've been in Israel.
Well, there's free choice, but the goal of the Israeli leadership and Israeli society is to bring all Jews to Israel to then have Jews there to plan the common future for the Jewish people. Well, why are there Italians? Why are there Armenians in America? There are, you know, this is a nationalism which is thriving, but not all members of the national group have chosen to participate.
Actually, if I had my druthers, I think they ought to go to Armenia instead of leaving the place. But they like wherever life seems to treat them better. They think they can create a homeland in Argentina and in Egypt or wherever they are. Actually,
right.
It's a gigantic myth. It's not possible. Anyway, we have 2 minutes left. And how would you like to summarize our discussion today about the history of Zionism and its relevance today? That's the important thing.
Yeah, I think that what's important to remember is that the Jewish people, which is an ancient people, one of the few remaining ancient peoples from the ancient world, has regained the ability through the creation of Israel and Zionism to chart its own future, to survive into the future, to chart its own future. And then I'm actually forgetting one other thing. The Jewish people view themselves as a light unto the nations. In other words, why are we still here? Why are we here and the ancient Romans, the ancient Greeks are not? We believe as a faith community as well that there's a godly purpose to our being here, to being a light unto the nations, to doing good, to doing good deeds, to showing the way and toward the future for not just the Jews but all mankind.
Well, that sounds like I like that. You know, God's decision. God's with us.
I would say that's true.
It's God's will.
Right.
First of all, let me thank you for coming. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
I hope our audience has learned something. And this definitely is an issue that is the root of our present problems that we have in the Middle East. And those of you who are always asking the question, my God, why is all this? And now you know why. You have to go back and find out. This brings our Crow program to a close, and hope to see you next month.
You are listening to Zen and Now, presented on...
Good morning, this is WHFR Dearborn. I'm Lynn. Stay tuned for Light from the Underground after these important messages.
Come on, baby, let the good time roll.
It's WHFR Radio's 9th annual charity bowling event. Staff members from HFCC's own WHFR 89.3 FM will battle on the lanes for a wonderful cause.